There was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape, or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it. Did it hurt? You bet it hurt. Like a bastard. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. For the woodland ape. You think about that.
What?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Is that Harry and the Hendersons?
You've seen it.
This is my life, Jack.
Yeah, it's weird. There's this, like, strange... I notice this a lot in ufology and clearly in Bigfootery, too. It's like there's this strange, bizarre, like, backwards, like there's this moral turpitude or something. I don't know what the word is. I'm searching for the word, but it's like there's this, like, guilt complex that they a lot of people put on you. Oh, you're just trying to sell books. It's like, well, I wrote the book. I want people to read the book. That's, you know.
Right. I mean, you put in, you know, 5 years of your life, you write a book, and then, you know, of course you're supposed to go out there and tell people you did it. You want it. But the ones that really bother me are the new author. The new author that comes along and he goes to, you know, all of these TV producers and hey, have me on your show. I want to talk about this. And so they give away their stuff free, and then some of the rest of us that have to make a living off of this, or I mean, I'm making a living off of, you know, a few hundred dollars in royalties and my Social Security. That's how I'm making a living.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I need to be guilty about that. But it's the newbies that are being taken advantage of. They appear on these programs for free. They do it two or three times, and then all of a sudden they wake up in a cold sweat and say, hey, I've just given away 3 weeks of my life. I still have to pay my rent. What am I going to do? And they begin thinking, I got to start charging some of these people for my time. And it's a vicious cycle that I've seen played out in ufology and ghost stories and Bigfoot. You know, it's just really, it does need to change. And I'm hoping the professionalism really will evolve in the field.
One would hope so, but given how long these fields have been around, it's like, it's just interesting to sit back and watch. I mean, you've been around for decades. It's just interesting to see. This stuff used to be so fringe. It's really crazy to me. It's like Bigfoot really has become this iconography that it wasn't when I was a kid. It wasn't even like maybe 10, 15 years ago. It's like really, it's I don't know. It's hard to explain, but it's like it's become a symbol that everybody knows, and maybe back like in the 80s and stuff, it was sort of more fringy, if that makes any sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, Robert Stack, he would get away with doing a Bigfoot story, a murder, and, you know, a missing person. And it was kind of like that was the fringy, weird thing that you talk about.
Right.
And nowadays, you got to come to the table with your Bigfoot story with a theory and with the DNA possibilities. And is it Gigantopithecus or Paranthropus? And got to make it all intellectualized. So much so that some people are actually taking the fun out of it. But
yeah.
I mean, it's like the museum. We're the only one in the world, and people browbeat us because we're a nonprofit. We have no, you know, endowment, and we charge $10 for adults and $5 for kids. And they're saying, boy, that's too much money.
What?
You're such a little, you know, yes. I mean, yet they can go downtown to the Science Museum that has one exhibit and everybody pays $20, or the Children's Museum where the children are paying $10, and we have to justify ourselves. So it's almost like it's happened in the museum world, too.
Yeah.
Where we have to think we have to feel guilty. Well, we're not doing that. You know, people can make a choice. They can come to the museum or not. They'll see things there like Jimmy Stewart's letter and Yeti hair, and you know, it's one-of-a-kind stuff. So we really got over that guilt trip that people would do. Or, oh, I don't want to come to your museum because it's only filled with toys. Yeah, that's because you're not reading the exhibits and not looking around.
Yeah.
It's very funny how people, you know, like I tell some individuals, Librarians are the best people to come to museums because they stay for 2 hours and read every exhibit.
Right, right. Yeah, I was saying this to somebody the other day. That was my one regret with my visit last year, which I will rectify when I come up for Labor Day weekend. We were hanging out, and I didn't really – I got the awesome personalized tour with Lauren. I should have spent more time studying the exhibits, you know. It was kind of like I had a real catch-22 there because we were getting toured by you, which was awesome. But it's like I there's so much I want to go back and see, so I'm going to be
– The way I usually classically do that, except for friends that want to hang around and just talk to me like you guys did, is I take people through, on these specialized tours, and then I say, okay, now you go back through at your own pace and read what interests you.
Right,
and
right.
And then, you know, then leave. But don't think that you're getting it all from me. I'm just giving an overview so you can kind of feel your way through, but then go back.
Yeah, we went out for lunch and gossiped like
right.
Like we
kind of
should.
Like when we went to Nova Scotia, you know, we had that. That was a great time.
That was a lot of
you
fun.
You and I, yeah, Stan and Paul, Kimball,
yeah,
and mostly we didn't really spend that much time at the conference. We learned more in the lunches that we all did and stuff, so that was good.
Yeah, yeah. I went up the second year, too. I think I might be trying to make it this year. It's a nice place. It's gorgeous. It's always It's always nice we can do you, yeah, you said you went out, you were in Wyoming, right?
Yeah, I did Wyoming, too, at a comic book con where they said that last year they had 13,000 people and this year they expected 20. But they made the mistake of having it on the same weekend as Mother's Day. So only got 6,000 people. But for me, it was, I mean, I've been to every state in the lower 48 in Hawaii, but for me, it was different to actually be in a city like Cheyenne for 6 days because I went to the train museum, I talked to locals and, you know, saw some of the weirder sites around there myself, other than just spending the whole time at the conference.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah, that's good fun.
I didn't realize that, you know, I think Kurt Gowdy was from there and Tom Horn and, you know, different, they showed me where so-and-so had been hanged on a certain corner.
Oh, wow.
So I just get away from the cryptozoology part sometime and just try to take in the local, like little tidbits, like 90 trains come through Cheyenne every day. I mean,
what?
Who
wow.
don't know? Yeah. You know, kind of really weird stuff. And you go to some cities, and I like all of the cultural diversity. So it was really neat to kind of go there and know that the cultural diversity for that town was African Americans who came out as black cowboys, but also, of course, Native Americans. So it was a real surprise. I didn't really know that. You know, there was that kind of diversity there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, that's cool when you can get a chance to explore a place like that instead of being in the hotel the whole time. But it was funny you said that. I was going to ask if you have like a Stan Friedman sort of roll call, but it sounds like you go all 48 lower states and Hawaii. So you haven't been to Alaska yet?
No, I haven't been to Alaska. So
you gotta do that.
I'm waiting for the Banal of America conference up there for me to go to.
I would do like a cruise to Alaska. I don't know.
yeah.
We can organize that.
The best thing is to take a cruise up, and then there's little tours you can go in. And I know all of the places where the Bigfoot-type creatures have been seen up there, including some great Thunderbird sightings in the lower part of Alaska.
Really?
So I check out those as well as the Kodiak Bear and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's interesting. So I thought it was interesting what you said about sort of people about Bigfoot being seen in all the different states. It's I guess where – I know you said the Pacific Northwest, but are there other areas that you think might really be the domain of these creatures? I mean, like Pennsylvania seems like a hotbed. And, of course, you know, the skunk ape down in Florida is a whole different thing. But, I mean, are there areas that you think, you know, are promising besides the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I think that what I've always felt deep down is the eastern Bigfoot or Wendigo – really may have some habitat in Quebec and Canada, and then they occasionally do migrate down to the, you know, Michigan, Minnesota, maybe some places in Maine. But I don't know if there's real permanent year-round Bigfoot residents in some of those upper northern states. It's much more about movement. And then if you look at all of the South, there's this whole problem with the skunk ape, the Honey Island monster ape, the booger, as they call it. And these are really apes which have a foot that looks like your hand. And they're more like chimpanzees. Sometimes, of course, they stand upright. But the classic Florida skunk apes that were talked about from the 1940s to the 60s were always smaller, always 3 foot to 5 feet, hunched over, even having green algae on their hair.
Oh, wow.
And those were all, it was only in the 70s whenever some of the hoaxers came down there and started filming some of their relatives in gorilla suits that people felt that the Bigfoot were being seen in Florida and, you know, Louisiana and Mississippi.
Yeah.
Those were really, that's the cultural Bigfoot that's really contaminated the rest of the United States, including the South. So I'm very, very suspicious about a lot of the Southern quote-unquote Bigfoot reports. And even though I absolutely admire the work of Linda Godfrey, the Dogman reports from Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, to me, those are nothing more than Bigfoot reports that are leaned over roadkill and eating and have little or nothing to do with dogs or werewolves.
Interesting.
I think that's another cultural contamination that really is changing the field. And it comes out of this excitement that people have to make this new and different. So, you know, our friend Ken Earhart had a dog man conference last year in Defiance, Ohio.
Yeah.
And that's great, and I'm glad to have, you know, the swag for that to have in the museum and stuff. But I really wonder, and I was even on Mysteries at the Museum about some art that we have that might reflect some of those sightings. But if you look at it from a distance, a werewolf-type creature standing up or leaning over looks like a Bigfoot, just with through a different lens.
Yeah.
And even, what's this, you know, the Nevada reports of that, the ranch, you know.
Oh, Skinwalker.
Yeah, Skinwalker. Skinwalkers are, and that I started getting reports of skinwalkers from Native peoples in the 1960s from New Mexico and Arizona. That's merely Bigfoot that just run. And most of the Bigfoot reports from Southern California and the Southwest are usually thinner anyway, reflective of the climate.
Yeah.
And so I think that people want everything to be alike and all to be Bigfoot and all to be all over the country. But I really do think it needs some discrimination between these reports, and you can really kind of begin to understand them based on biology as well as sociology.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So I don't think there's a roadie. I don't think there's a Rhode Island Bigfoot call. It is called Brody by people that have made that up, but I don't think there's
yeah.
I don't think there's really substantial amount of physical evidence of a Bigfoot running around. Anyway, it would be part of the mafia. So,
oh God, there you go. There you go. Now you say Wendigo. I think I probably have an idea of what that means, but sort of flesh that out for me so I know that I know what it means.
Well, Wendigo is an Algonquin Indian word for, you know, a cannibal, a Bigfoot-type creature, and it's got all mixed up because psychologists came along years and years ago, and they decided to diagnose the Wendigo syndrome, whereas if you go out in the wilderness and you start turning black from frostbite and a whole bunch of other things, and you have a Wendigo psychosis where you want to turn into a cannibal and a human being eating another human being, but also killing people.
Jeez.
And that is confusing to people, because the native peoples, the Algonquin Indians and others, have talked about Wendigo, which is just an eastern Bigfoot, for 400, 500, 600 years. And it's because the psychological world has taken over the name that then it's got confusing for people doing reports.
Right, right. And the other thing you said that kind of piqued my interest, which maybe I'm wondering if applies to the whole to the various creatures as a whole, is that maybe these creatures, these animals, or for lack of a better term, that they're migratory, that they're not necessarily like. So maybe if somebody sees one in Massachusetts, it's like there isn't a Bigfoot in Massachusetts. There was one; it was passing through, kind of thing. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think for a lot of the Eastern reports, one of the differences between the Eastern Bigfoot reports and the Western ones, it is a truism that most of the Western Bigfoot are very calm, are very peaceful, are almost, they've been compared to mountain gorillas.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Eastern reports that you really dig into and find out and try to get a whole history of over several decades, like Cobalt, Ontario, has frequent, about every 30 years, there's a kind of a flap of reports, of Bigfoot reports, like they're passing through the area.
Hmm.
And they do it in these waves. But like in Michigan, whenever you dig into some of those reports, like at Sister Lake or, Monroe, Michigan, they've had violent interactions with individuals like Christine Van Acker, who got a black eye. She was driving with her mother in her car, and the creature reached through her window and gave her a black eye, punched her in the eye.
Jesus.
The Louisiana creature, Louisiana, Missouri, Momo, that was first seen with a dead dog in its arm, dripping blood.
Oh, my God.
There's reports of a newspaper guy, a delivery man, one morning in Ohio, coming across the Bigfoot, crossing the road, and it had a dead animal, once again, dripping blood. And so over and over again, like the recent one of the recent films that Seth Breedlove did, on the Minerva Monster, which was in Ohio, it also had violent interactions with dogs. I think that the population density of humans in the East actually make it very uncomfortable for Bigfoot-type creatures to stay around for long.
Yeah,
they come into an area, they screech, they leave footprints, they kill a little livestock, they kill off some dogs, and then they retreat back into Canada or Quebec, or any place up north.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think it's seasonal. I think very similar to Thunderbird reports where, for instance, in Illinois, the late Mark Hall and I worked on this a lot and looked at the migratory routes where in the spring they were actually coming down into the Midwest, down into the United States, and then the other way around. They would do it seasonally, April, November, one way or another way, north, south, just like the big birds do. And I think it's very true with the Bigfoot-type creatures, too. Whereas the Black Panthers, the mystery cats, they go east and west quite a bit. And they
interesting.
And they don't really care about the weather. They're not affected by the weather the same way Bigfoot would be.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Is there... I don't know if you know who Peter Davenport is, but he's been around ufology like forever, and he's got the National UFO Reporting Center, and it's a pretty exhaustive. It's like a 1-800 hotline type thing. I guess what I'm wondering is there any like clearinghouse for Bigfoot reports? Is there any like one place that people can report these things?
Well, I think pretty well established is the BFRO, the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, and they have a system where, auditory reports and reports with, it's almost like Close Encounters at 1, 2, and 3. They have a system there where they try to divide it up, and if it's just a sound in the woods, they usually don't follow up.
I hope not.
You know, they have a bunch of what they call curators or associates where they send out reporters and, I mean, investigators where they try to delve into it more. But it's my problem with any of those kinds of things, they really disappear into a database and they don't identify the eyewitness. And that, of course, causes problems because then researchers that are trying to double-check the report or follow up or do data variation and correlations,
yeah,
it's hard as heck to do it.
So you can't. So it makes Bigfoot sabermetrics difficult, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. And the other problem, of course, is that we used to, I mean, you're right. I've been in this since March of 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And way back when, you were able to get newspaper articles that would say, you know, John Smith at 123 Longview Place said he reported such and such a creature.
Right.
And you would track him down. And, you know, there weren't that many people. Ivan Sanderson once told me in 1965,
yeah,
there was only 5 people in the country investigating Bigfoot. Well, now, you know, if I had some kind of app on my phone, I could probably press and see that 5 people up and down this block would be interested in Bigfoot.
Right. So yeah.
There's so many people that once there's a report out there and there's an actual case with an address, that person, you know, people are beating on their door.
Well,
did I ever tell you about the lawsuit that was filed against the book Weird Ohio?
No, tell me this story.
I wrote the Bigfoot and Cryptozoology and the Strange 40 and Earth Work stories in that book.
Mm-hmm.
And, the folks that were putting those, Barnes & Noble, when they were putting those books together, they did a great job. They, you know, I have 2 editors, and then they'd pick 1 to 3 authors. I was one of those authors. Well, all of a sudden, I got this nice formal subpoena and forms and say, you know, you guys are being sued, and what? Well, what had happened is somebody who owned a house that was haunted said that ever since Weird Ohio came out, that people were coming around and knocking on their door and trespassing, and it was just a horror story and a real horror story. Well, we went all the way through the courts. We had to get, you know, luckily Barnes & Noble gave us lawyers. It turns out that the people that had written that in the book could clearly show that there were newspaper articles published before the book came out showing these people's address.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the cause of it. So we, you know, I did, the suit didn't last very long, but it really told me how things had changed in this country. We used to be able to track down eyewitnesses pretty clearly, but because of litigation, you see less and less addresses in the newspaper, and you have less and less claims of trespass.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
You know, harassment and stuff, too.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
But it's really changed, and that I find is sad. One of the, I think, happy points about reality TV is, especially on this program called Mysteries and Monsters on Destination America.
Yeah.
I really congratulate them because what they have done to try to make their programming a little bit different is they have tracked down eyewitnesses of some of these old famous cases. You know, some kid that was 12 years old that saw Momo,
yeah,
all of a sudden they're grown up and they're interviewing them. And needless to say, people don't live forever. So they're actually creating major archives of eyewitnesses around some of these cases. And like, for instance, I was able to interview Linda Scarberry before she died. And I think that's always great that some of these classic stories, are filmed by some of these companies. So I give them 5 gold stars.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny you're talking about the how there's 5 Bigfoot researchers and now you can go up and down the block. It's like, it's interesting in a way, if you look at it, the ghost thing on TV sort of predated this Bigfoot explosion, but it's really mirrored it in a lot of ways too, because now it's like each sort of state, each sort of like community, you know, different parts of states, they have sort of like Bigfoot groups now that have kind of sprung up. You know what I mean? I think there's one for Massachusetts called Squatchachusetts, and they had a Bigfoot thing in Western Mass earlier or last fall. So it's like
I was there and I gave a talk. Yeah.
Oh, nice. There you go. Yeah. So it's like it's becoming very strangely sort of localized. I guess that's good. I guess that means more people are interested. But it's like you know, it has its pluses and minuses, but it's an interesting phenomenon, let's say.
Yeah, it is. And I think that I saw that certainly in the 50s and 60s with UFO groups.
Yeah.
I think during the 80s and maybe the 90s, you saw all of these, you know, Minnesota ghost hunters groups spring up. There's not that many cryptozoologists that's going around to conferences that are what are called paracons.
Yeah.
Because I was a Fortean. Identified as a Fortean long before I was a cryptozoologist, people know that I'm interested in strange stories. So I get invited and find out that Jason and Grant said they became ghost hunters because my book, Mysterious America. And, you know, that's really, it feels really good about that. But I also, what's happened is this evolution of ghost hunters really did follow the UFO trend. That UFO groups really were social networks.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing it with Bigfoot groups, because those people are interested in friendship, they're interested in getting outdoors, and they're interested in mysteries. So what a better way to do it than through Bigfoot? I mean, you don't see mystery cat groups. You don't see lake monster societies too often. Over in, I do think that it is happening over in Australia, that there are some groups of people hunting thylacine.
Mm.
So that is happening over there. But you're right. I think that they are springing up everywhere, almost every state. And what I've been amazed by in the last 10 years is, as a outcome of that, some of the groups that met locally, maybe monthly or maybe quarterly, all of a sudden decided, well, we're going to do a national conference.
Yeah.
And so in the last 10 years, there's now a calendar, and you can just type in Bigfoot conference and you'll go to the website, and they list all of the conferences that are happening all over the country. And I think there's a good 12 to 20 per year, and it's just getting more and more that they can't even – the weekend that we're doing our conference, you know, cryptozoology, which is Labor Day weekend, there's a out in Kennewick, Washington State, there's a Bigfoot conference, and there's also a habitation conference in Washington, in another part of the Pacific Northwest. So it's just, there's even multiple conferences on the same weekend. And that, I think, is something that people used to avoid because they wanted everybody to only be able to
come to
one conference or another. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this year, the 50th year of the Patterson film, Willow Creek, which is a really little town, they're having, you know, they had one in April. They're going to have another one in August, and then another one in October.
Oh, wow.
Because they're certainly taking advantage of the 50th anniversary, and they actually get enough people to make it worthwhile. And I think there must have been 3,000 people. It was just a kind of a vendors conference. There wasn't any, well, there was a couple of speakers inside, but it was mostly, you know, meet the Finding Bigfoot people and meet Bob Gimlin. And that was about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, it's amazing actually. Yeah. Cause the UFO, there's still a lot of UFO events, but I see a lot of Bigfoot events. It might be because, I'm more plugged into the community, but as you're saying, it seems like it's really popped up a lot in the last few years. Now, you said a habituation conference. If I went to a habituation conference and there was no Bigfoot there, I'd ask for my money back. Isn't that kind of the whole point?
Well, you could do your stand-up comic routine there. That would be good.
I'm sure that would go over well.
That's true. Yeah. But like in Ohio, where Don Keating used to have conferences 20 years ago, he started out with little groups every week, every month, that were 20 people. Then he did one of these conferences, and there must have been 150 people there.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, Mark Stewart, he has a conference there, and he has enough vendors and people going through the vendors. I think he counted 1,000 people last time.
Oh, wow.
And that's just, you know, that's like better than funeral directors can get. So, you know, it is interesting to see it. I wonder if it's getting with finding Bigfoot stopping, you know, I'm wondering if this sort of growth of the conferences will follow the baby boomer. You know, are the baby boomers going to die off and then those conferences will go down, you know, in numbers, or are we going to have a kind of crossover trends where we have, you know, the Twin Peaks Bigfoot conference or something?
Well, kind
of, because nobody's really taken advantage of, you know, comic books and Bigfoot or anything like that. They're so strictly, you know, ghost hunting. Well, the Paracon has tried to do that a little bit, but I'm usually the only Bigfoot guy. It's usually all ghost people and then me.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, each field has its own sort of ecosystem in a lot of ways. I remember when we were at that mass monster mash in Watertown, which is famous because of the bombing and everything. That's where they found that guy in the boat. There was someone there. I don't even remember her name, so I'm not even like – this isn't really a diss. But she was on one of these ghost shows, and she was like selling 8x10 photos of herself autographed. And it was like, what is – Who wants to? And she was selling them. People were buying them, and it was like, "What is this? How are you? You're not a celebrity. I don't get." But to different people, different audiences, they are. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. It's I mean, at the Comic-Con that I was just at in Wyoming, you know, there was Billy Dee Williams, and he was selling, you know, his pictures for $75. And if you did that at Bigfoot conference. You know, even if you were Cliff or Bobo or Bob Gimlin, you would be left laughed out of the room.
Yeah, only unless you're Bigfoot. That's about it, right?
Right. I mean, I tried that because everybody said, "Oh, you should do this at Paracons." So I brought some, you know, photographs with the Bigfoot in background, the one that you saw up in the museum.
Oh yeah.
And I said $5, you know, and I'll give you a photograph. And it's a $5 donation to the museum. I couldn't sell one. There was 10,000 people there. But what's her name? Anyway, it was some horror woman that was sitting across from me.
Yeah.
And she could, you know, just put them out there for $40 and sell them.
So, it wasn't Elvira.
No, it was the woman that just died. Betsy. She was in the Elm Street.
Oh, I have no idea.
Anyway, yeah, it was one of those people.
Go ahead.
Sell their photographs. That's all the more power to them.
Yeah, hey, if you can sell, yeah. Yeah, it's just funny to me. It's like there's an audience for everything, so it's pretty remarkable. Now, in the email you sent me, we were kind of batting around the show here, you mentioned something, and I glossed over it in a sense because you're not familiar with these shows, but it sounds like you have thoughts on this because you said the impact on the return of X-Files, Twin Peaks, and the new American Gods on reality programming. So what sort of planted that seed in your mind to mention that in the email to me, you know, when we were setting up the interview? What do you think is going on with that?
Well, I think that if you look at those shows, American Gods has never been on TV, but it's really in talking to Neo a little bit, he said that in a future episode, he was inspired by my book, Mysterious America, to put Thunderbirds, cryptozoological creatures in that, Thunderbirds from the Fortean literature.
Yeah.
And X-Files, Chris Carter actually used, not for the mythos of the alien part, but if you look at his stories the first season, every other week or so it was Monster of the Week or, you know, some kind of Fortean phenomenon like frogs dropping from the sky or lake monsters at Heuvelman's Lake. A lot of people pointed out to me that he was using my book and other people's books as sort of a roadmap. And now we're having the return of those. And so I'm wondering if, and Westworld is the other one I was trying to remember, that there's almost a return to existential experimental science fiction. And that people and the programmers seem to be getting more interested in that than the reality shows that we just came through that were on Bigfoot or Mysteries at the Museum or Destination America. They're going to go into reruns, by the way, of Finding Bigfoot is going to be on Destination America.
Yeah.
So people are going to be, you know, have 10 years of reruns of Finding Bigfoot. That, to me, says they won't need a new program.
Right.
Because there's actually some kid that was, you know, that's 18 now, when he was 7 years old, he wasn't watching Finding Bigfoot. So it's all going to be new to him.
Right.
And so I really think that these waves and these trends really are markers. In my book, Bigfoot, I wrote about how everybody is really imprinted when they're about 10 to 13 years old. So everybody that grew up whenever the Boggy Creek, you know, the legend of Boggy Creek was in the drive-in theaters.
Yeah.
They grew up thinking about Bigfoot in a certain way, as a real creature that invades you when you're on the toilet. You know, that happened in that movie. And then 10 years later, what came along for those other than 10-year-olds was Harry and the Henderson. So people became skeptical of Bigfoot. They thought it was a joke. They thought it was unreal.
Oh.
It would come into your house and crush your, you know, your Davenport or
yeah.
whatever. And it's really different. So as you track Bigfoot films, you can really see how it changes and it sets up a whole new generation to be skeptical or open-minded or really not even interested. So I'm wondering, as we're coming to this decade-long sort of affection with reality Bigfoot, it's now fading into really fictional shows that are outrageously stupid, or like Killing Bigfoot, which doesn't last long because they're so horrible.
Right.
And then the more popular shows for people that are trying to think, and that's really the distinction for me, like Twin Peaks or X-Files or you know, Westworld. People are going to be more interested in going the science fiction route for Bigfoot. And I wonder how that's going to paint the, you know, the canvas for the future.
Yeah. Well, now that you mention it, I'm stunned that there hasn't been a remake yet of Harry and the Hendersons, considering they mine all these old movies for reboots. It's like, I don't want that effect to happen to people, but yeah. I'm stunned they haven't revived that franchise.
Well, I think the problem that happened there is that they tried to make it into a TV series.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, that TV series worked for a while, and then they even tried to make it an ongoing exhibit at Universal. With, you know, Harry and the Henderson jumping out. I went there one time and saw that, and it was like, wow, this is not going to work.
yeah.
So I think they kind of pushed it to the limit.
Yeah, but, you know, I can imagine there's some executive who's, you know, pressed for an idea, and he's like, "Hey, this is a hit movie, and we got a TV show out of it, and we got a ride out of it. So let's bring it back," you know. So
yeah,
nostalgia's a hell of a drug.
Yes, it is. It is. Well, I think that we'll see some more Wonder Woman, you know, Redux.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, yeah. But yeah, it's remarkable. The whole thing's interesting. This has been a great conversation. This is like jazz. We're just bouncing back and forth. I really didn't really bring too much to the table as far as what I wanted to talk to you about. Now, what about some of these? I've been always really bullish on the Orang Pendek because I feel like through my friendship with Adam Davies that it's a very promising lead in a lot of ways. What do you think about the creature? I mean, you think it's possible? I feel like if there was anything that we were going to get, I feel like we're closer to that one than a lot of these other ones.
Yeah, well, and Patrick Weege in my book, The Field Guide to Bigfoot and Other Mystery Primates, that the first edition came out in 1999, and then we rebooted it in 2002 because there were so many more discoveries. At the end of the book, I did a best bet. You know, what were the top 10 or 12 of the primates that I thought would be discovered? And, you know, everybody always hopes Bigfoot or Yeti or different things like that. My number one on the list, and I was very clear about this, was Orang Pendek. I think of all of the hairy hominids that are unknown around the world, that is the one that is going to be discovered within the next 25 years. And I think it's going to be a real earthquake to anthropology. It's going to shake up people who have been so debunking and so skeptical. I don't think that it's really human-like. I think it's more orangutan-like.
Yeah.
But even if it's a brand new species of orangutan that is mostly upright and runs through the trees and different things like that, I think the evidence is so good. I think the sightings, like Deborah Martyr, who's been over there a long time. Debbie, I was able to get her visa for her by being in a university in 1985. And she wanted to go over there to study Orang Pendek as a journalist, and then she became a conservationist. She once said to me, "I've only seen the Sumatran rhino twice, but I've seen Orang Pendek three times."
Oh, wow.
I really think that there's something there. I know that Adam has certainly found the footprints. He's found what he thinks is DNA. And so there's some real credible people. There's some real, local people. Even Cliff Bachman has been there and has identified, eyewitnesses and has come up with a footcast from there.
Yeah.
There is the confusion with the small bear that some people take the footprints of the bear and they mix it up with the Orang Pendek. But, you know, we've been through that, and Ivan Sanderson even saw those differences. I think that it's clear there's something going on that's totally interesting and totally related to some of the other things like Homo forensis, the hobbits on Flores Island, and some of the other reports from Indonesia and even over to Sri Lanka where they have the little people reports. So I'm very encouraged. It's top of my list. I'm hoping it happens in my lifetime. But even if it doesn't, I certainly am very hopeful. The only problem is, and I started noticing this when MTV came on TV, the MTV generation, we started having researchers that were into rock and roll and into MTV, and they got no patience. They thought that...
Not
you. But there was some guy that even wrote it up in the San Francisco newspaper. His name was Kyle. And he really didn't understand that the pyramids were not built in a day.
Yeah.
And it took 60 years to discover the Mount Gorilla, 75 years to find the first giant panda. It's just not going to be things really quickly with Orion Pindeck. And you also have to wait for science. I mean, they've got to write the papers. They've got to have, verification. Science moves and academia moves very, very slowly. So
right,
I'm hopeful Orion Pindeck's really going to be found.
Well, I don't have the article in front of me. I mentioned this to Adam Davies, but it's ironic with this thylacine story with Dr. Lawrence. There's also a pair of conservationists that are going to the quote-unquote like lost world part of Sumatra. There's an article in The Guardian about it about 2 weeks ago to document sort of exotic species that are there that we know about. But in the article, just with one little line, it was like, the area is also said to be home to this creature called the Orang Pendek, and, maybe he's there. So it's like, so there is this, and that's very similar to the other study. They're going to put a whole bunch of game cameras, throughout this whole area, and just to document the animals that are there. So you just never know. I mean, I'd like to see more of these things. I guess you'd have to have a lot of money, but I mean, if you blanketed an area with game cameras, I wonder if it would work with Bigfoot. But who knows?
Yeah, I mean the caveat with Bigfoot is that Bigfoot will never be caught on camera because he can smell the metal or he can hear the clicking.
Right, right.
Outside our range, so there's always one of those sort of catch-22s, and it may be true. The other thing is if you go into the area and blanket it with 100 trail cams, you're also going to lose 85 of them because people steal them and sell them.
That's true. You'd have to be you'd have to be pretty secretive about what you were doing, yeah. Yeah,
well, right.
That's what that guy in Australia said. Yeah, they have to avoid the yabos, which is, I guess, Australian for fools and clowns or whatever. But
Yeah.
But I do think that if either one of those things, the one in Sumatra or the one in Australia, if either one of those produce anything tangible, I'm really hopeful that that will set about some new interest in trying to approach it that way. Because now this dovetails back to what you were saying earlier, because I wanted to ask you about this DNA thing. We were really bullish about that a few years ago, and nothing really has come from that, in a sense, right? I mean, we've kind of hit the wall on DNA, right? Is there anything we can do?
Well, I don't know if we did or we didn't, because Brian Sykes, I'm not even going to talk about the Ketchum study.
Yeah.
That was really a waste of DNA, as Brian Sykes says in his book. And I was glad he said it. I was glad it was said out loud that she got 120 samples from around the world and that nothing came from that. And those samples, of course, got destroyed. And the whole business about, the Bigfoot was evolved from an angel with another creature. It went down a track that none of us should have, all of us should have seen coming and been careful about.
Right.
Anyway, Brian Sykes got 34 samples or so. Most of them came back known species. But if you read his book extremely carefully, like I did, I noticed that a sample of a Bigfoot from the Pacific Northwest links up with some DNA from humans in Central Asia. And that's worth noting and pursuing. The sample of the Amas, which links up to some DNA from Africa, is also worth pursuing. And then the other one was the Pambouche hand. Now, the Pambouche hand is the one that I got very involved with Tom Slick and Peter Byrne and all of those folks, mm-hmm. got that sample in 1959. That's the sample that Jimmy Stewart, after Peter Byrne stole it from the monastery, or let's say picked it up from the drunken llama, and then put it in his backpack, walked into India, hooked up with Jimmy Stewart and his wife at the hotel. Then Jimmy Stewart put that in his luggage and got it back to England to study by Osmond Hill. that sample was resurfaced a few years ago, and they tested that, and they said it was human. So nobody paid any attention to it because they thought this was a 350-year-old bone of a llama instead of at the time in 59. Everybody said, no, this is a Yeti. We need to test it. But we, you know, back then, they didn't have DNA. They just looked at it and said it looked like the metatarsals of a Neanderthal.
Right.
So it was very, very exciting. What happened with Brian Sykes, he retested it with new possibilities where you could get rid of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually found that the human that was being identified on that bone was actually from an individual, one specific individual by the name of Peter Byrne.
Oh, wow. Really?
Who had picked it up, who had handled it,
yeah,
given it to the scientist, and it was, people were doing a false negative, a false positive of saying it was human. It wasn't human. There's something else there. So what I'm saying is that if you look through that whole book and the whole DNA study, I'm very excited by it because we need to restudy the Pam Boucher hand, the finger bone, because it could tell us that there's something there that's unidentified. It's some unknown hominid. Back in the day in 59, they had this test where they found the eggs of a parasite that was only be identified with a new primate. So there was already hints,
oh, weird,
that they were finding unique things that never could be pursued too deeply in 59. But here we are in an age when we could go deeper into that bone and find out. Because Brian Sykes was actually the person that first identified Neanderthal DNA.
Right.
So he has a very credible history of doing good work.
Well, there's an interesting question. Where is that hand now?
Well, the hand was stolen after it appeared on Unsolved Mysteries in 1991. Somebody came along and stole the whole rest of the hand.
Oh, what?
He had, Peter Byrne had taken the bone that got tested on a piece of skin. But then after it appeared on TV on NBC, it got stolen from the monastery. So.
Ugh.
Because there's this whole underground market in antiquities.
Oh, yeah, somebody, I'm sure that was one-of-a-kind piece.
Yeah, so on somebody's mantle, probably in, you know, Saudi Arabia, there's somebody there with a hand of a Yeti.
Well, we need that hand. Somebody send it to the International Cryptozoology Museum.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, if anyone finds a weird shriveled hand like in their grandparents' attic.
Yeah.
I don't know. Send a picture first. Lauren doesn't want a whole bunch of dismembered hands being mailed to Portland.
Yes. Well, I've got fecal material in the mail, and that was pretty disgusting. It actually ruined.
Hey, listen, how many times do I have to apologize for that? Oh, man. All right, so we'll do the wrap-up here. We're in, the last 10 minutes. CryptozoologyMuseum.com is where people can go to find out about the museum, and it is at 4 Thompson's Point Road.
And
the conference, of course. I was going to get to that. Don't worry. It's at 4 Thompson's Point Road, and as Lauren was saying earlier, folks, this is I'm excited to get back up there Labor Day weekend for the conference because you could tell when I got up there, I can't remember when exactly you opened it. When did you open in Thompson? About a year ago, you said, right?
Yeah, July 1st.
Yeah. So I was there in August, so about 2 months after it opened. And you could tell just from looking around that this was a place that was on the grow. And I'm looking forward to getting up there and getting a look at it. You know, the whole setup, the whole area, because you could tell it was going to be a real bustling place. And based on everything I've seen just from the museum, it certainly seems that way. So I'm looking forward to getting up there. And like I said before, I'm really psyched that, you know, you guys are sort of like this anchor of this place and getting the respect you deserve. And I'm amazed every time I see these stories, that I'm not surprised, but I'm just amazed and so happy for you that, like, you know, Today Show. I can't even go down the list. You know them better than I do. All these mainstream national outlets talking about the museum. It's well deserved and long overdue for you to get the recognition of this place and how awesome it is, and that people really are finding it and checking it out.
Well, thank you, Tim. Appreciations.
And yeah, like I said, I'll be up there. Oh, I want to ask you one more thing about the Wessie. Do you have what do you have from Wessie there? Do you have that big skin they found?
Yeah, actually, the police department finally turned the skin over to us because they wanted it in a nonprofit museum where it would be shown all of day, every day. So actually, it's up on the wall right now, but we've noticed that because the skin is brown and it's on natural wood, I'm going to redo it and put it under plastic and put it lower down so like students and everybody can see it in a better way.
It's
12 feet long. And
wow.
They never found the body yet, but we're waiting sort of with bated breath when it really heats up here to see if it's going to come back.
Yeah, I remember seeing the articles toward the end of the year where they're like, no way, is it? It's dead now if it's around. So I'm hoping that it makes an appearance again just to get the last laugh on,
right.
on the
right.
skeptics. But yeah, it's really a magical place, folks. It's really, really awesome. And like I said, all these people that are like, talk to me and they say, oh, it's on my bucket list. I want to go. I want to check it out so bad. People from around here, Labor Day weekend, folks, they're rolling the red carpet out for you on an awesome event with this conference. And, you know, I got to lock it in, but I'm like 99% sure I'll be there. So
okay, good.
I'm looking
forward
to it.
And all of those other people, we're open year-round, and we're open 6 days a week. We're only closed on Tuesdays. So many museums close on Mondays. We're the only one in Maine to be open on Mondays.
Interesting. Why are so many museums closed on Mondays?
I think it's their day to resupply and clean up. And for us, you know, people need an alternative, so here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if you've already committed to going to your nephew's barbecue on Labor Day weekend, you can get up to the museum anytime. Just go to the website and check it out. And I can't put it over enough. It's awesome. I wish I'm going to try and make it more of an annual trip for me because I had such a good time last year, and I really think folks should check it out. And I can't thank you enough for coming back on the show, Lauren. I know you're incredibly busy you know, so giving me 2 hours of your time, it's really, really appreciated. And I loved this conversation because we just went where the road took us. And I really, really enjoyed it so much.
Right. The jazz of cryptozoology.
Exactly. That's what I'll tell folks when I post it. And that's it. You got another website you want to plug, or is that good, Crypto?
No. I have fun, lots and lots of fun talking to you, Tim. So it's great to touch base again.
Absolutely. All right, man. Thank you very much. I guess you can just hang up. We're all good, and we'll call
all
it a
right,
night here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much again. I really appreciate the conversation.
Okay. Night-night.
Good night. There you go, folks. That was Lauren Coleman talking about all kinds of cryptozoology stuff and the Twilight language material as well. Just great stuff. I love talking to Lauren Coleman, and I didn't want to embarrass him, but it's just been such a thrill to have him as a friend of the program and a personal friend for all these years. It's really been great. He's been kind of like a mentor to me, somebody I can email or call and ask for advice and stuff. And as I said, when I went up there last year, we got to go out for lunch and kind of talk shop about the business of the paranormal, which we really got into a lot tonight, and I thought that was awesome and interesting and really enlightening. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in there for people who are in this field just starting out, or people who've been in it for a long time, because I learned a lot of things just now talking to Lauren, sort of about how to make your way in this crazy field and deal with a lot of the, you know, the weirdness of it all, and trying to make a life in this. You know, it's a special type of person, a special breed of people that, you know, go from consumers to producers. And you know, Lauren's been doing it for decades. I've been doing it for over a decade now. It can be a toil, but it's a lot of fun at times like tonight when you're talking to somebody like Lauren Coleman. So, like I said, I can't put him over enough. He's the man. And, folks, go to the museum. If you get a chance, you want to check out the museum. It is really awesome. The British lady's in my ear now. So we plugged the website numerous times, so you know how to get to it. And I guess that's it. So thanks to all the folks who tuned in on the live show and the folks in the chat room, Alligator, Digger Dog, Jim Lydica. Thanks for your insights as we went along tonight. And we'll do the plug for next week's show. We're going to try and get it out of, get it done within the live cast here. Next week on the program, June 13th, 2017, the amazing and indefatigable and prolific Nick Redfern returns to BOA Audio. I'm sure we're going to be talking about his new Roswell book. We're going to get into, I'm sure, sort of like that, I forget the name, the Collins Elite, demonic alien theories. Sure, we'll get into cryptozoology. It's probably going to be a lot like all the shows so far this season, where we just jam, man. We just jam and cover whatever's on my mind next week, next Tuesday night. So, and hopefully, like tonight's show, no politics. get away from the craziness for a few hours and get into the weirdness here on Banal of America. So that's it. Next week on the program, Nick Redfern, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That's June 13th. And, yeah, he has a new Men in Black book that came out as well. So I love the Men in Black. We're going to get into that also. So all kinds of stuff. There's so much stuff I could talk to him about, a lot like tonight's conversation with Lauren. Tons of different topics that we can cover, and I'm sure we will. So until then, this is Tim Banal. Thank you for listening and signing off.